National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns, is brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check out their website at cybersecuritysummit.org for a list of their upcoming webinar series. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, and you joined us for this edition of National Security This Week. We get together every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security, and we're fortunate enough to be joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us learn more about national security challenges and opportunities. Sometimes we're joined by guests from around the world, and today our guest is joining us from Australia. So we are actually pre-recording this show at 6 a.m. Central Time here in the United States, and our guest, John Blaxland, is sitting in Australia, and it's about 11 p.m. his time. And we'll play this show in the normal time slot. A quick note before we get started, my friend Eric Sanderson over in Seattle sent me a text message a little while ago saying that this show, National Security This Week, the podcast, was the featured podcast on his service. So we are on podcast services if you have an interest in listening to the show as a recording. For today's show, we're going to be taking an in-depth look at Australia, one of the most important strategic allies the United States has in the Western Pacific and Indian Ocean. We're going to look at security through the lens of the Australians. When you're living down under, as they say, looking north into the Western Pacific and the Indian Ocean, you see many security challenges, but you also see many opportunities. We're going to explore both in discussions this morning. Our guest today is Dr. John Blaxland. Dr. John Blaxland is Professor of International Security and Intelligence Studies at the Strategic and Defense Studies Center at Australian National University. He's also a Senior Fellow of the Higher Education Academy and a Fellow of the Royal Society of New South Wales. In addition, he's a member of the Australian Army Journal Editorial Board and an occasional commentator in the media. John holds a doctorate in war studies from the Royal Military College of Canada and a Master of Arts in History from Australian National University and a Bachelor of Arts from the University of New South Wales. He's also a graduate of the Royal Thai Army Command and Staff College and the Royal Military College at Duntroon, which, as I understand it, is roughly the equivalent of the U.S. Military Academy at West Point here in the United States. Dr. Blaxland has extensive experience in the intelligence community, including as the Principal Intelligence Staff Officer for the Australian Brigade in East Timor in September of 1999, and also as an Intelligence Exchange Officer in Washington, D.C., as well as Director of the Joint Intelligence Operations, the J2, at Headquarters Joint Operations Command with Australia, and as a lead author of the 3-volume history of the Australian Secret Intelligence Organization. He also served during his career as Australia's defense attaché to Thailand and Myanmar. Dr. Blaxland is widely published, and his research covers the intelligence and security arms of government. He also covers Australian military history and strategy. He looks at defense studies, at military operations, and international relations, notably with Southeast Asia and North America, to include Canada and the United States. Dr. John Blaxland, welcome to National Security This Week.
John, great to be with you. Thanks very much for inviting me on the program. What a pleasure to reach across the Pacific and engage with you on this amazing technology that we're sharing this morning.
I really do appreciate the fact that you're staying up late to pre-record the show with me. The 17-hour time zone difference that we have between Minnesota and Sydney is quite a significant thing to overcome. But as you said, the technology is making all of this possible for us. Dr. Blaxland, we have a lot to cover this morning. There's so many things I want to ask you. Why don't we go ahead and get started? To begin with, if I were to ask you to summarize what Australia's top security concerns are right now, how would you respond? What nations or crisis points or situations are of the greatest concern from Australia's perspective?
Yes, so great question. And I would answer referring to a paper I wrote a little while ago called A Geostrategic SWOT Analysis for Australia. And the SWOT is a business concept where you look at the internal strengths and weaknesses and external opportunities and threats. And what I did is I applied it geostrategically to Australia's broad circumstances. And I was working through a long list of all these strengths and weaknesses and opportunities and threats. And I presented it to my wife and I said, look, aren't you impressed? She'd look at how good this is. And she said, so what? She said, so what, John? And I said, dang, that hurts. That really. So I had to think a bit harder. And what I realized is I needed to distill this further. And in distilling it, I came up with this an overlapping Venn diagram of great power contestation, looming environmental catastrophe, and a spectrum of governance challenges, all within a context of the fourth industrial revolution, which is accelerating the trends on all of those fronts. And that manifests itself in a series of challenges, which for Australia are geographically in Southeast Asia, in the Southwest Pacific, in our relations with neighbours in across the Indian Ocean as well, and of course further afield with our traditional security partners and allies, the United States, the United Kingdom, and beyond. And that's manifested itself in the Quad partnership, the quadrilateral dialogue with India, Japan, Australia, and the United States, and the recently emerged AUKUS, a technical agreement between Australia, the United Kingdom, and the United States. Along the way, you know, we've managed to offend a lot of people. we've put a lot of French noses out of joint. We've annoyed the Indonesians. We've annoyed neighbours across the Pacific. We're broadly speaking well-meaning people, but we're what I like to call WYSIWYG people. We're what you see is what you get. You know, we're not terribly subtle, we're not terribly nuanced, and we're certainly not inscrutable. Unlike, you know, some of our Asian neighbours, we're not good at playing poker. You can read us like a book, you know. but you asked me about the crisis points or the situations of greatest concern for Australia. So I think that prism of great power contestation, environmental challenges and governance challenges, and the technology that's accelerating all of that is driving a range of concerns. So we had a foreign policy white paper a couple of years ago come out, and it was like, well, it looked like a scattergun approach because we're touched on everybody. You know, we're touching about all our neighbours in Southeast Asia, neighbours in the Southwest Pacific, our ally, you know, the United States, the Five Eyes partners, you know, the UK, New Zealand, the firepower defence arrangement, kind of a bit of a historical relic that still has relevance for our ties with Malaysia and Singapore, along with New Zealand and the United Kingdom, a whole range of networks, and of course the more recent ones with Japan and India that have emerged from their concerns over a rising authoritarian and assertive and rule-breaking emergent power, central power in Asia, that is the People's Republic of China. So all of those leaves us with a long list, you know. So I group them in Southeast Asia, and I group them in the Southwest Pacific. And when you think about Southeast Asia, obviously the most important one in that space is Indonesia. Australia is a country of 25 million people. You know, we're the size of continental United States, but we're a minnow when it comes to population, largely because we don't have the Mississippi River Delta in the middle. We've got, you know, we've got the stony desert. You know, it's really bone dry out there. So we live essentially on the rim of the continent. But for us, Indonesia is really critical, even though it seems a long way away, because most of us live on the southeastern corner in the southern parts of the country. And Indonesia's, you know, to fly from Canberra, the capital, or from Sydney or Melbourne, you know, it's a 6-hour flight before you cross the country, before you get to the off the coast to the north of Australia on your way to Asia. And when you do, you cross, you get in East Timor, and then you get Indonesia. Now, this is a country that is, it's like water and oil to Australia. It's so different. It's, you know, 10 times our population, literally 250 million people, a country that economically we used to be stronger and more powerful, but they're actually overtaking us. And let's not forget, this is a predominantly Muslim country. Now, it's a leading democracy. It's a rambunctious, messy democracy. And it's one over which we've had a series of, you know, contentious issues to resolve. in terms of not only the crisis over East Timor in 99, which I'm happy to elaborate on, but on refugees, on border illegal border arrivals, demarcation of disputes, and disagreements on a range of very sensitive issues inside Indonesia, which, you know, in a democracy like ours, you get protest groups want to, you know, complain about the prosecution of West Papuans or the suppression of women's rights or whatever inside Indonesia. And the Indonesians get completely offended by these upstart, you know, people down south who look like the Dutch colonial masters of old, you know. So we clod hop our way around our engagement with Indonesia, not realizing how we cause offense inadvertently along the way. So Indonesia, main one in Southeast Asia. And then in the Pacific, obviously Papua New Guinea, a big country. After the First World War, Australia was given the League of Nations mandate to govern on an interim basis, Papua New Guinea. And of course, we then did that. And then we fought in the Pacific War in that space alongside the United States. So PNG is very important, but of course the other one's really important is Fiji and Solomon Islands. Solomon Islands, it fell between the cracks in our consciousness for a long time. We forget that the Battle of Guadalcanal got fought in the middle of Solomon Islands.
Right.
Honiara, the capital of Solomon Islands, is its airport is Henderson Airfield, Guadalcanal. That was where the battle. Why? Because it was right smack in the middle of the lines of communication between Australia and North America.
Yeah.
But, you know, so there we have it. We've got a range of issues. And, of course, domestically, politically, there's a big debate. How much emphasis do you put on great power issues? How much to put on environmental issues? And how much do you deal with corruption and governance and terrorism and other problems in the region?
Sure.
Oh, it's a long list.
John, you sound like somebody who has studied history a little bit.
I am a bit of a history buff, John. Yeah. You're absolutely right. Yeah.
Let's drill down a little bit more on that relationship with Indonesia, if we could, for this next question. A little deeper analysis, maybe, on the Australia-Indonesia relationship. Do Australians look at Indonesia as an actual military threat, or not so much? Is it an economic opportunity for trade? What's sort of the driving factors in that relationship between Australia and Indonesia?
Yeah, so historically, back in the middle of the Cold War, during the kind of end of the colonial era, when Indonesia had been independent for about 20 years, but Malaysia was getting its independence from Britain, Singapore and Brunei were emerging as independent nations, Sukarno, the president of Indonesia, fought a war, what he called confrontation against Malaysia, against the British who were still hanging around in Malaysia, kind of holding the hands of the Malaysians as they got their independence set up. So we actually joined the Brits and the Malaysians in defending Malaysia against the Indonesian incursions. So there has been ever since that was, you know, mid-1960s. So that's almost 60 years ago. There's been a residual kind of fear of what Indonesia might do. But when you look at Indonesia and you go to Indonesia, you realize that their defense force is actually, when it's not consumed with internal domestic security concerns, it's focused northwards. It's not focused southwards.
Okay.
So from an Australian security point of view, Indonesia has not really presented a significant challenge. In fact, arguably, it's part of the reason why we have such a small defence force is because we don't have contentious borders. We have got a honking big bloody moat, you know, around Australia. We're an island, you know. So, I mean, you know, try your luck. Come, you know, give it a shot. I mean, you know, what are you going to get? What are you going to find when you get to the northern coast of Australia? You're going to find very hardy Aboriginals who are, you know, attuned culturally, you know, who for millennium, you know, 60,000 years have been living on the land and have adapted to harsh conditions. And if you ain't one of them, you're going to struggle to get water and food. Let me tell you, it's really tough. But I mean, I'm being a little bit flippant there. But the point is that there is in common Australian, you know, sense of consciousness, an uneasiness about Indonesia, this very big country that's 10 times our population, with so many, you know, it's more predominantly Muslim. It's a democracy, but it's a rambunctious one, and it's a fairly young democracy. And we've had a number of points of contention, and it's been over live cattle trade, what I call beef, boats, spies, clemency, Timor, Papua, and Jerusalem. So all of these issues that come up, often triggered by domestic political issues in Australia, and we feel the need to lodge a protest in Jakarta, the capital of Indonesia, about an issue of concern in Australia. And it goes over like, you know, you know, a proverbial,
right.
I'm thinking of some inappropriate, you know, kind of sounds.
I understand.
In church.
Yeah.
So the Indonesians, you know, many of them actually have studied in Australia. The elites all speak English fluently. And we struggle with getting enough people in Australia who can bring themselves to learn Indonesian, you know, in contrast to in the States, where you have a lot of people who speak Spanish, say, or maybe French. In Australia, you know, we're barely monolingual. We barely speak English. I mean, you can tell that by the way I'm speaking to you. I mean, what kind of English am I speaking? You know, it's a weird dialect, right? I'm being flippant, I know.
I understand.
It's to make a point. Now, economically, Indonesia has not featured very prominently in Australia's calculations, partly because we're kind of a competitor, that we don't trade that much with them, or we're trying to do more. And we've got this new Indonesia-Australia Comprehensive Economic Partnership Agreement. So there's a lot of effort, a goodwill on both the Indonesian and Australian side to bolster trade, because we know that trade helps deepen, helps provide ballast to the relationship. But one of the mainstays of relationship has been really about the security dimensions, police and the military. So we have an alumni of defence graduates from Australian programs who are amongst the, you know, the most prominent senior figures, military and political figures in the country. So that's been an investment over time. Similarly with the police, we're very heavily involved in that, particularly over the last two decades, since the Bali bombings of 2002, when Australia had about 80 Australians. My numbers are probably a bit off, but many, many Australians were killed in this tourist resort of Bali, and along with more than 100 Indonesians. And that led to an opportunity for Australia and Indonesia to kind of let bygones be bygones over the East Timor crisis of 99, enable us to work closely together. Now, just wind back the clock a bit back to the East Timor crisis, because I think it's important to set in context. Back in 1975, you know, this is the height of the Cold War. Saigon had just fallen to the North Vietnamese. Phnom Penh was about to fall to the communists. There was the Portuguese had this leftist revolution in Portugal, and they let go of all their colonies, including East Timor. And what was left in East Timor was a group called Fretilin that had Marxist connections. And the Indonesians, who by this stage were under President Suharto, a US-aligned, an autocrat who was US-aligned and sympathetic to Australia. And the Australian Prime Minister at the time thought, well, you know, we don't want another mini Cuba on our doorstep. You know, Cuba was bad enough for you guys in the States. We don't want a mini one between Indonesia and Australia. So there was a bit of a nudge, a wink, and, you know, Henry Kissinger was involved in a bit of shuttle diplomacy as well, of course, back then. And lo and behold, President Suharto agrees he's going to take over Indonesia, but they do it in a ham-fisted way. And five Australian journalists got killed in the mix, which got And the Indonesians denied that it ever happened, but there's clear evidence it did. And so what was supposed to be this gentleman's agreement that, you know, you guys just, you know, manage East Timor and, you know, set up some kind of plebiscite, a bit like they'd done in West Papua in the early 1960s. West Papua, another piece of real estate, just north of East Timor, the western half of the Papua New Guinean island had been a leftover historical legacy when the Dutch fought a war of independence against the Indonesians. They when they gave independence in 1949, the Dutch held on to West Papua. There's a honking big gold mine there, right? It's a really rich resource place. So the Dutch wanted to hold on to this. The Indonesians eventually persuaded them in early 1960s to let go. And then in 1969, they had this UN-endorsed so-called Act of Free Choice. And they got a handful of, in the hundreds of leaders of the communities, and basically said, you do want to join Indonesia, don't you? Don't you? Right. And of course, they all said, yes, of course we do. Right. So Indonesia took over West Papua. And I'm being a little bit, I'm perhaps a little bit oversimplifying the matter there. But the point is that there was a sense that, well, you know, West Papua went to Indonesia. Why can't East Timor? Just because it was run by the Portuguese for 400 years and they're Catholic now and they've got a slightly different culture. Well, it's a small part of the archipelago, really. It should be part of Indonesia. This is the thinking back in 1975, the height of the Cold War, right? Yeah. So, as I say, everyone thought that was a great idea until it wasn't a great idea anymore, particularly when five Australian journalists got killed for basically witnessing the invasion. So that then led to a really kind of tricky and problematic relationship between Australia and Indonesia for the next quarter of a century, from 1975 until 1998, when after the Asian financial crisis of 1997, the president of Indonesia, Suharto, had been in since the coup in 1965. He was toppled. His successor wants to change things, wants to be a bit more democratic. And at that point, the Australian Prime Minister at the time, John Howard, writes to the president of Indonesia, a guy called B.J. Habibie, and says, look, have you thought about maybe having some kind of autonomy, a vote for perhaps, can ask the Timorese if they'd like autonomy, rather, because Australia wanted East Timor to stay part of Indonesia, but we just felt that they weren't managing it very well. Anyway, he was a bit of a taciturn guy, and he reacted fairly strongly, and he decided, no, it's either you're in or you're out. And they vote for that, and we'll do that as soon as we can. So lo and behold, they had a plebiscite. The Indonesian military really didn't want that to happen. They helped foster a bunch of militias who went on a rampage when the plebiscite went against the Indonesian wishes, and then Australia was called in. So Australia was called in. We were reluctant, one fellow, a guy called Clinton Fernandez, an academic at the University of New South Wales, called it the reluctant saviour. And there's a book I'm reviewing at the moment about the official history of the intervention in East Timor by Professor Craig Stockings, and he called it Born of Fire and Ash, because essentially the place got absolutely trashed in September 1999, right? Absolutely trashed. So Australia goes in, we're the reluctant saviour, and the Indonesians are deeply resentful at what we've done. But it's like, hang on, guys, chicken or egg here. What happened? We this isn't because of us. You guys made some calls and then you handled it pretty poorly. And we didn't want this to happen. So we have had a very prickly relationship over the years. It's a bit like a game of snakes and ladders with Indonesia. So we make some incremental progress. So we've made progress since then. With the silver lining of the terrible catastrophe of the Bali bombings was the opportunity for us to collaborate on tracking down the terrorists. So that was great, very productive. And then we helped them. There was the Indian Ocean tsunami in 04, 05, and Australia offered help, and we helped rehabilitate Aceh, this province on the northwestern tip of Sumatra, the northwestern part of Indonesia, jutting out into the Indian Ocean. Mm-hmm. And the silver lining of that was that, well, it helped, we were kind of, they realized that we weren't real ogres. We're just, as I say, we might be clodhopping, but we're not ill intentioned. So we're now in a situation where Indonesia is actually dealing with a resurgent China that is throwing its weight around on the northern fringes of Indonesia's territory, maritime territory in the South China Sea.
Sure.
And they are really uncomfortable with what China's doing. And this is where there's a overlap now of Australia's interests and Indonesia's interests that is seeing the prospect for deeper collaboration and enhanced coordination of security dimensions and other dimensions of our bilateral relationship. That's also a space for potentially greater US involvement as well.
I'd like to actually get a...
Oh, no, we didn't talk about the jihadis.
Well, let me get there. I do want to follow up on that towards a little bit later in the show, but that is definitely an important topic. Australia has had internal challenges with some of these Salafist jihadis, sadly. So from your perspective, and I could just maybe ask you to do 3 to 4 minutes on this, as you look out across the Indian Ocean from Australia's west coast, do you have any concerns for security, economics, or politics around the Indian Ocean periphery? I know you mentioned the partnership with India, clearly a natural ally as part of the Quad discussions, but there are those who would caution that India, under a nationalist political party led by Modi, not maybe quite as reliable as one would hope. And an example of that is that India is still buying Russian oil, filling Russia's coffers as they continue to prosecute their war aims in Ukraine. So how does Australia kind of view broadly the Indian Ocean? It's a big body of water. There's a lot of space between Western Australia and the African continent, for instance, but also southern Asia on the north side of the Indian Ocean. Just a few minutes on that, if you could, John.
Sure. So for us, the trade routes of the Indian Ocean are critical. So we have traditionally, back in the old day, back in the 19th century, the line through the Suez Canal, which opened in 1867, was the lifeline, if you like. It was the main trading route to Europe. So we traded east to America and west, northwest to Europe via across the Indian Ocean via the Suez Canal through the Mediterranean. That line of communication remains critical for everybody. It's still very important to Australia, and that's one of the reasons why the Royal Australian Navy is often operating in alongside US task groups in and around the Horn of Africa, the Persian Gulf, Strait of Hormuz, and places like that, recognizing the significance of the trade and the oil flow and the trade flow through that and through the Red Sea as well. So we've a significant investment in that space, and we've played there ever since the 1870s, really. Australia has always seen that part of the world as something we have a bit of a stake in. But when it comes to East Africa, the western coast of the Indian Ocean, Australia has considerable investment in mineral projects because we're pretty good at mining, and we've done a lot of that in Australia. We dig a lot of things up, iron ore, coal, and things like that. We dig up a lot of, and we have corporations that do a fair bit of that in Africa. So we've got a stake there in East Africa, and we're obviously getting a bit squeezed by the Chinese there, who are really working, both ends of the candle, if you like, burning both ends of the candle to establish themselves there, to consolidate their economic toeholds there and consolidate their interests in East Africa as well as West Africa. When it comes to India, though, of course, there's the interminable dispute between India and Pakistan. And Australia's struggled, much with the US as well, struggled to maintain a positive relationship with Pakistan and India. But it's devilishly difficult to do that at the same time because they are just kind of inveterate, opponents of each other. Makes it very, very difficult. And of course, they're both nuclear armed powers. The Modi challenge is an interesting one because there is an unease in certain circles about the apparent erosion of inclusiveness and political openness inside India. And that is a worrying development. But let's not forget, none of our democracies are perfect.
Right.
Certainly Australia's isn't. And of course, we get we get a lot of news from the US as well. So, you know, I don't think any of us can go around throwing stones in glass houses, to be quite honest. Yeah. But the challenge for India is that they have relied militarily for Russian equipment to be the counterbalance against China. And they've been, you know, they've suffered attacks from China just in the last 18 months or so along the in the Himalayas on the line of actual control. So they're in a real conundrum. They want to keep China in check. Most of their armed forces, going back to the days of the Cold War, have Russian or Soviet style equipment. They're trying to wean themselves off that, but that's hard to do quickly. And they're trying not to burn their bridges with Russia, and they're trying to stay in good with the West as well. So I don't envy them at all. They're in a really tricky spot.
Sure. That is a great summary. And if you think about it, the Belt and Road Initiative on China's part, the belt part is the maritime sea trade routes, you know, creating ports all around, you know, the trade routes from Western China over to Europe. Gwadar port in Pakistan and Hambantota port in Sri Lanka are now both owned and operated by China. So what we're really seeing is the belt side on the maritime side, and then the road side through Central Asia. The whole design of that economic investment on China's part is to box out and isolate India. So India, as you say, has some very significant challenges.
I'm shocked to hear you say that. No, India's up against it. I mean, it's one of the reasons why they're reaching out to the Quad.
Yeah.
The Quad matters more to India than ever before.
Yeah.
Because they're getting squeezed. And, you know, Russia is not as reliable as it was, and they're trying to keep in good there by buying that oil from Russia, which, of course, the country still needs. I mean, it's you know, it's got 1.4 billion people to feed and clothe and look after. But the China challenge is enormous for India, although the demographics would suggest that India's, in the long run, got better prospects.
Yeah. John, we have to take just a quick break to recognize our sponsor, the Cybersecurity Summit. We'll be back in just a moment.
National Security This Week is sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit. The Cybersecurity Summit brings together cyber experts from industry, academia, and all levels of government to explore challenges, solutions, and opportunities in the cyber arena. The three-day summit includes speakers, workshops, discussions about advancing a cyber career, and keynote addresses by top leaders from across the cyber community. Learn more at cybersecuritysummit.org.
And we're back with Dr. John Blaxland, and we're talking about Australia's national security challenges. John, let's follow up a little bit more on the China issue. I know that China has really been levying some pretty significant political and economic pressures on Australia for a few years now. Could you describe for us what it's been like in trying to deal directly with China and the pressures that Australia has been under?
So Australia has been subject to political interference, and that's been most notable. A few years ago, there was a senator in one of our senators, and our Senate is similar to the United States. We have an equal number of senators per state, but we have 12 senators per state because we've only got six states and two territories, as opposed to two senators. Anyway, one of our senators from New South Wales, the largest by population, the state with the largest population in Australia, got bought off, and he got caught out because he was mouthing PRC, People's Republic of China, talking points about the South China Sea, which were in contravention to the party, political party platforms, points on that issue that for the party that he belonged to, the Labor Party of Australia. Anyway, that then led to there was other things happening. There were cyber attacks happening. There was a reaction in the Australian body politic on both sides of the aisle, on centre left and centre right. There was a sense of no, this is enough. We've got to change the dynamics here, and so that led to some legislation being introduced that restricted the ability for China and others to interfere politically in domestic politics, more transparency for funding and for resources that are allocated to political campaigns and things like that. And of course, the situation started to get worse and worse over time, because we then blocked the sale of Huawei technology in Australia for good reason. You know, they've got their ability to operate and then hoover up, you know, vacuum up information from Australia for exploitation and then use against us. The risk was just too great. Mm-hmm. There was a consensus in government, once the intelligence community briefed the both sides of parliament, that this was dangerous. They all agreed. That generated a reaction. And then, of course, we saw eventually Australia being slapped with sanctions, $20 billion worth of sanctions, particularly when our foreign minister, Maurice Payne, at the time, basically called out China on COVID and said, come on, let's have an independent investigation. Well, that was above and beyond the pale, you know. Now, Maurice Payne, the foreign minister, probably could have handled that a bit more delicately. As I say, we're a bunch of clodhoppers. We're WYSIWYG people, you know. What you see is what you get. So the Chinese took a front. They decided to try and teach us a lesson by imposing these sanctions on coal, on wine, on lobsters, on barley, on wheat, and other things that we sell in by the truckload to China, right? We've been making money hand over fist because the Chinese love what we do. And now, interestingly enough, it didn't work. President Xi wanted to punish Australia, but guess what? We managed to find other ways, because, you know, the bottom line is that while President Xi might like to think he exercises a command economy in China, the global economy is not a command economy. There's supply, there's demand, there's bull markets, there's you know, there's bear markets, there's feast, there's famine, there's droughts, there's floods, and there's changing trends. So, you know, if you don't want to buy our barley from Australia, okay, buy it from, I don't know, Argentina. Guess what? The market that barley was going to go to all of a sudden opens up, and then we can sell our barley there. Yep. So it's like it was nugatory. And by the way, our trade with China went up anyway, despite all of this. So it's like, and now eventually we're seeing now China post with Xi backing off of the wolf warrior diplomacy, rhetorically at least, if not in substance, we're seeing a winding back, at least the talk of the winding back of these sanctions. So we'll see how that goes in the next little while. But what we've seen is, you know, a real sense and a growing sense in Australia, and we've seen this with the industrial scale cyber attacks on a range of corporations, on government entities. My university's been subject to multiple attacks. Thankfully, our security measures have ratcheted up. But what we've got is a much greater awareness of the cyber challenges today than ever before. We've gone from being a web-enabled society to a web-dependent society to a web-vulnerable society, and now increasingly a web-savvy one. And that's a good thing. And, you know, the irony is, of course, that China, behind its great firewall, likes to operate in our domain, but it doesn't let us operate in theirs. So everybody loves a good set of double standards, I guess, but China is masterful at exercising it.
So that's the kind of the political and economic side of things. I want to make sure we talk about the security side, if we could, just a few minutes, because you sort of touched on it a little bit earlier. But Australia's security situation vis-a-vis China, how does Australia view China's activities in, say, the South China Sea or the Western Pacific more generally? As we know, China recently crafted an agreement with the Solomon Islands that has vexed Washington, D.C. Frankly, it's probably a bit of a concern for folks down in Australia as well. From the U.S. perspective, it's frankly a direct competition for influence between the United States and China over a part of the world that has been in the U.S. camp since World War II. How does Australia view these recent developments?
So this has been part of the awakening, if you like, the kind of greater consciousness of the competition we're facing. And I think there's a point of reference that's useful. If you remember back in 1999, two Chinese colonels put out this book called Unrestricted Warfare, right? And at the time, people thought, oh, come on, isn't that a bit over the top? You know, Unrestricted warfare, really? Who are you talking about? Anyway, it got buried for a while. But when you think of it, I've gone back and looked at it and thought about it and thought, dang, that's exactly what's been going on. Now, we've got hung up on the word warfare, because when we think about warfare, we think about kinetic effects,
yep.
You know, artillery, missiles, you know, guns, people getting shot. The Chinese approach is very different. And I think because they talk about media warfare, political warfare, legal warfare, right? Now, I think if that's all been going on, if you shift away from thinking about unrestricted warfare and put in the word competition instead of warfare, you think about this as unrestricted competition, that's what we're facing.
Yeah.
We're facing unrestricted, the gloves are off, but it's competition. People aren't getting shot, ships aren't getting sunk, but it's pretty darn close, right? It's close, but not quite. And they're pushing right up to the envelope. And that's been happening with the pressure. This gets back to what a point I made at the start about the great power contestation, looming environmental catastrophe, and the governance challenges. The governance challenges includes brown paper bags stuffed with money buying influence, right? That's corruption. That's a governance problem.
Yep.
And when Australia tries to influence, you know, we, like in the US, we're constrained by, you know, our liberal democratic laws that preclude us from freaking stuffing paper bags full of money and
right.
handing it under the table.
Yep.
Which is like, so we've tied our hands behind one back and the other guy's just handing him over, you know, hand over fist. So this is the world we're operating in. It is unrestricted. And it's extremely competitive, and it's an understandable competition on one level, because I like, to my mind, there's a metaphor that works for me, and that is that you think about the British Empire. When Sir Francis Drake, you know, sailed the ocean blue in the 1700s or 1600s, he didn't have a manifesto to conquer the world.
Right.
It happened incrementally, right? It happened because of the Industrial Revolution, where they needed markets and they needed raw materials for their cotton mills and their factories, and they needed market, you know, they needed somebody to buy their stuff off them, and they needed to buy off them the raw materials to make the factories work, right? And that then led to desire to provide security for, you know, East India companies and then governance for them, and guess what, to fight wars to protect them. And lo and behold, you have the Opium Wars in China, you have the wars in India, you have the wars of, you know, I mean, the colonization of North America, the United States, and Australia. I mean, you know, we're all part of it, really. We're
yep.
we're all a manifestation of it. But the point is that's okay, John. That's a quaint historical parallel. The point is that if we think about what China's doing now, it's a kind of condensed and accelerated version of that, because they've been growing like topsy-turvy. They've needed raw materials and they've needed markets and they've needed investment. And then they've gone to the east coast of Africa. They've established mines. They've established roads, bridges, helped with governance. And then they felt the need to protect it. So what? You need security elements. A lot of them are hired companies. So there's a degree of plausible deniability about it being the state doing it, even though the state-owned enterprise is doing it. But, you know, there's this half arm's length removed kind of process from governance. But that's, you know, that's on one level a perfectly understandable one. The problem, though, for us is that it's from a government that's increasingly authoritarian. And while we had kind of hoped that its Marxist, communist trappings would fall by the wayside as they fell in love with capitalism, that just hasn't happened. And Xi has reversed course.
Yes.
Xi is kind of, you know, the hide and bide of Deng Xiaoping's era, the hide your strengths and bide your time. Well, they're not hiding and biding anymore. They're out and about, and they're confronting Australian vessels, Australian warships in the South China Sea. We don't call them freedom of navigation operations, but it's essentially pretty much what we do. We just don't call them that because the US takes a slightly different approach for a couple of legal reasons. And also the fact is the United States is bigger. You guys can do it. We can't afford to wear it. We're a small to middle power. So there's that. But there's also the encroachment in the South Pacific, Solomon Islands being a classic. And, of course, the the arbitrary and capricious nature of its engagement with Australia over trade, over politics, over cyber attacks and the like. There's a sense that we actually, and then got to back that up with the fact that the People's Liberation Army, Navy, Army and Air Force have been growing like topsy-turvy, and they've been increasingly getting into this idea of jointery, of cyber, and of space. Now, these are the domains that, you know, they're cutting edge concepts in Western military thinking, but they are also being closely paralleled in China. So you think, okay, so why are you doing this, China? Who's the threat? Because Japan never did it when it was in the on the rise. Remember in the 1970s, 80s, 90s, everyone thought China was, might be a threat. China, Japan might have been a threat because it was economically so powerful. Of course, Japan never invested in that kind of, because it wasn't trying to upset the apple cart. Right. It was quite happy with the order. China is not happy with the order.
Sure.
It wants to upset the apple cart. And of course, Australia is hugely invested in its relationship with the United States. We have more foreign direct investment from you guys than anyone else. But even money aside, the bottom line is, look, we're pretty simple people. I know we barely speak English, but it is what one of the things we have in common. And most of us don't really want to learn Mandarin.
Very briefly for our audience, you're listening to National Security This Week on KYMN Radio, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. John Blaxland, and we're discussing Australian national security concerns and opportunities. We're sponsored by the Cybersecurity Summit, and you can learn more at www.cybersecuritysummit.org. So, Dr. Blaxland, on that point, Australia has been hosting U.S. military forces for many years now. The U.S. Marine Corps rotates Marines to Australia for combined training on a regular basis. Australia has also, as you mentioned, routinely supported crisis operations in the Middle East, usually in direct partnership with the United States. How important is the U.S.-Australia security partnership to Australian national security interests? And maybe you could address a little bit more of the details of the AUKUS agreement that you mentioned earlier in the show.
Yeah, so Australia, you know, for the first half of the 20th century, we looked to Britain as part of for protection. In December 1941 through to February 1942, that got completely flipped on its head. And John Curtin, the Prime Minister of Australia, basically declared that he looked to the United States free of pangs of emotional attachment to the United Kingdom. We looked to the United States to help us. Now, we helped ourselves too. We had an army in January 1943 that had 14 divisions out of a population of 7.5 million people. We raised 14 divisions, and we'd fought. You know, we had four divisions fighting in the Middle East, and then we had most of those divisions rotated through the fighting in the Pacific theater. So we pulled our weight, but we couldn't do it without the United States. And so, you know, Eisenhower is known to have advised when he was the chief of staff at the Pentagon that Australia was useful as a base from which to push back against the Japanese thrust in the middle of the war. So MacArthur came south. We then established a relationship with the United States from that time. You know, the 1st Marine Division, its core song, its song is Waltzing Matilda. Its badge is the Southern Cross. The connection with Australia is profound. But that's not enough. We then had the ANZUS Treaty signed in 1951 in the middle of the Korean War, when Australia was one of the first countries to contribute forces alongside US forces as part of the UN command in the defense of South Korea. But even then, the ANZUS Alliance is a 800-word essay that says very little. It's not NATO. There's no NATO headquarters. There's NATO-like command structure. There's an agreement to consult. But what there is a period of 70 years of deepening security ties between our two countries that were one strand at a time. The Vietnam War reinforced this. The establishment of the joint facility at Pine Gap reinforced this. The intelligence ties that go back to the Second World War, but that were the trust and the bonds from those days were then pursued during the Cold War and deepened and broadened. And then, so we then got to the point where, you know, at the start of this millennium, Australia had led this mission to East Timor, and I got to be posted to Washington as an exchange officer in DIA, one of the few people it trusted to be inside the skiff. A manifestation of a deepening, broadening set of relationships that happen incrementally over more than my lifetime. Right? But interestingly enough, of course, there were no, after World War II, there were no US forces based, had bases in Australia. In fact, very interesting, we kind of got a little bit nervous because you guys packed up your bongos and you left and you said, well, see you later. It was nice, Australia, but we're off to Japan and we don't really care that much, and the Philippines, and look after yourselves and go back to the Brits. Then, of course, Korea happened, then Vietnam. Things changed, but we never had a permanent presence of US forces, unlike in Germany, unlike in Britain, unlike France until the 1960s, and unlike Korea and Japan. So for us, and the Philippines until you got kicked out of Clark and Subic, for us, the relationship with the United States is close, but not as close as you might have thought, because we didn't have those intimate ties of a permanent, that did come with a permanent presence. So we had to work that relationship. And of course, for the last two decades, we've worked it particularly through our engagement alongside the United States in Afghanistan and Iraq and across the Middle East, and now in the Pacific as well. So the presence of the Marines is consequential, but numerically not that consequential.
Yeah.
What there is, though, across Australia is the goodwill in Australia, the infrastructure in Australia, and the compatibility and the interoperability that's evolved over the last 70 years to the point where, you know, we're almost plug and play. You know, an Australian piece of kit and a US piece of kit, you can work together, we understand each other. You know, there's a thing called, a friend of mine said this to me. He said, John, it's interoperability between the ears. And I thought, that's a really powerful thing to say, because it's not just written down. It's about how you think and how you work.
Yeah.
And on that level, that's where we are.
So very briefly, so we have about 9 minutes left for our show. Could you just talk a little bit more about the AUKUS agreement, the Australia-UK-US agreement? I know it's sort of focused on a technology development. Submarines were sort of a main part of that. Is there anything else to the AUKUS agreement that's really critical for us to know?
Yes, so nuclear propulsion is the bedrock of what's going on, but resilience, missile production, weapons production, ammunition stocks. The Ukraine war has demonstrated we both need to up our game.
Yeah.
We need to be in a position to be much more robustly postured. One of the problems back in 1942, when we needed help, we wanted to buy, Mustangs, we wanted to buy Shermans, we wanted to buy kit that you guys had, but you guys needed it at the same time. So we couldn't, we had to build our own. Now, we actually did okay in the end, but the point is that you don't want to, when the crunch time comes, everybody's going to be in demand. So you've got to be preparing for, we've got to move away from just in time to just in case. And that's part of the transformation of AUKUS. AUKUS is also about nuclear propulsion is really important for Australia. If you want to move a submarine from any port to any other port, you can't do it submerged. And nowadays, with persistent AI and surveillance and sophisticated persistent surveillance, you are detectable. As soon as you snorkel, you are detectable. So, and if you lose your stealth, you might as well pack up and go home, right? There's no, you aren't useful if you're not stealthy. So for Australia, nuclear propulsion restores stealth, and it gives us range, it gives us endurance, it gives us speed. And for a population like ours, where you can actually have, six or eight boats do what 12 boats or 14 boats can do, that's a big plus. Of course, the time frame is long, so we've got to try and be clever about how we work with the UK and the US to build the capability in Australia, collaborate effectively in the meantime, and get us somewhere near there in the short to medium term. But beyond this, I think there's an important dimension, and I mentioned, ANZUS being an 800-word essay. One of the things that's worried Australia for a long time, we've got this kind of schizophrenic fear of abandonment and fear of entrapment. The fear of abandonment, it goes back to 1942, right? It's that kind of fear of being left out there and out to hang out to dry. For us, AUKUS is a mechanism that goes some way to add more structure, more mechanisms that tie our countries together. And that is seen as a good thing for Australian security. And look, in part, I think it also goes some way to reassure the United States that we're serious about our partnership with them and with the United Kingdom. And conversely, it's about keeping the United States engaged in Australia, because I think there is, broadly speaking, a recognition that Australia is of importance from a national security point of view for US interests globally.
Absolutely.
But there may be, in some elements, a degree of a slightly isolationist mindset in certain political circles. And Australia is pretty keen to demonstrate our bona fides, our goodwill and our intention to remain a positive influence alongside the United States in the Indo-Pacific, probably for generations to come.
And I should emphasize for our listeners that this decision, this AUKUS agreement, this technology on the nuclear propulsion side for submarines, this is a significant financial commitment that Australia is making as part of this agreement. Yep. And a strategic one. I mean, we're talking 50 years going into the future of commitment to this kind of technology base. So, John,
yeah, it's a gamble.
Yes,
it's a gamble, but it's basically based on a faith in the depth and the breadth of the ties between our countries that we see as being enduring.
Yeah. So, John, we have just about 5 minutes left. I know you have a new book coming out. The title is Revealing Secrets. It's about SIGINT and cyber. Can you tell us a little bit about that book?
So, basically, I go back to briefly to ancient times to explain cryptography, the origins, because a lot of the principles still apply in SIGINT. So I then look at how Australia's SIGINT is influenced by the US and the UK experience of SIGINT. I go a little bit back to the US Civil War, to the First World War, the British experience of empire, and talk about the First World War, and then focus more on the Second World War and the intelligence architecture that emerges with the breaking of Enigma and the Purple, the ultra secret and the ability to decipher and decrypt and work out the enemy's plans through SIGINT, and how that's laid the foundation for the post-war architecture, the trusted ties between our countries that have endured, that have stood the test of time, and that have helped us actually manage the transition from the analog era to the digital era. Our first computers in Australia were IBM computers that came with MacArthur's Southwest Pacific Area Command. After the war, we got more IBMs, and we kind of then went into Cray computers like everybody else did. But this was also the hearth for the digital era. It was the hearth for cybersecurity. And so in Australia, the Defence Signals Bureau, as it was formed in 1947, became what is now the Australian Signals Directorate. Even so, the title is kind of, it's a bit of a misnomer because it doesn't really accurately describe what it does. But what we've seen now is with the Australian Cybersecurity Centre, this introspective bunch of geeks who have been looking at the radio frequency spectrum and ones and zeros and computers have all of a sudden had to be a bit more extroverted and reach out to the public and explain to people, hey, you need to watch your cybersecurity, to schools, to industries, civil society organizations. So the book is walking through that journey, explaining how Australia, its own SIGINT and cybersecurity domain emerged, and how intimately it's connected with its Anglosphere partners.
So that's going to be a great book. I think you and I are both career professional intelligence officers. I think it's really important for us to understand kind of the foundations of intelligence to understand kind of where we're going in the future, especially considering all the modern challenges we have. We just have about two minutes. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I'm just going to say there's also the need to educate our people about the importance of this function.
That's
this
true.
Is not a nice to have, it's a must have function.
Yeah.
And most people have not got the faintest clue how it works or why we have it.
Right.
And that's what I'm trying to do.
Yep. So, John, I try to give my guests the final word. We have just a couple minutes left. What haven't I asked you today that I should have? Or are there any issues that are really important to Australia that we should, you just want to comment on in the last minute or so that we have?
So there are a lot of security challenges in our neighbourhood, and we, Australia and the United States, really need to work collaboratively, in particularly in the Pacific. We've got the Pacific Partnership that President Biden signed off on. We've got challenges. We've got a lot of competition. We need to be thinking long-term about how we respond to that. But it's got to be more than just military. It's got to be about economic. It's got to be about felt needs. And in the Pacific, that's about climate change. And also, there's other ones in the region like Myanmar. I think collaboratively, you know, we can do more to address challenges. We've been distracted to a certain extent by the great power issues, but there are creative ways I think we can actually help bring around a lot of countries like in Southeast Asia who are kind of hands off and don't want to buy in on the great power conflict and contestation. I think there's a way of engaging those countries on issues important to them that will help them understand why we are their partner of choice on issues in the Pacific, in Southeast Asia and beyond. And that requires imagination. It requires a bit of restraint, a bit of self-awareness, but also a sense of history and a sense of perspective. And that's where I think you and I can make a contribution.
So that's a great wrap-up, John. There was there. Unfortunately, there were a whole bunch of topics we didn't get a chance to get to today.
Yeah.
This hour-long show goes by just like that. It's absolutely amazes me every single week. Thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. John Blaxland. It is late. It is midnight now for you, I guess, down in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on the show, John.
So we've come to the end of our show. This closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining us today. I look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly look at issues affecting America's security concerns with host John Olson. It's brought to you by the Cybersecurity Summit. Check their website, cybersecuritysummit.org, for a listing of their upcoming webinar series.